The next coach had more troopers from headquarters company. His squadron sergeant major was in the back of that one, reading a paperback. "Hey, Colonel," the sergeant major said in greeting. "Long ride, ain't it? At least 3 more days to go, maybe 4. "Super," the senior non-com observed. "This is worse than flying." "Yeah, well, at least we got our tracks with us." "Yes, sir." "How's the food situation?" "Well, sir, we all got our MREs, and I got me a big box of Snickers bars stashed." "Any word what's happening in the world?"
"Just that it started in Siberia. The Chinese are across the border, and Ivan's trying to stop 'em. No details. We ought to get an update when we go through Moscow, after lunchtime, I expect."
"Fair enough. How are the troopers taking things?"
"No problems. Bored with the train ride. Want to get back in their tracks, the usual."
"How's their attitude?"
"They're ready, Colonel," the sergeant major assured him.
"Good." With that, Giusti turned and headed back to his seat, hoping he'd get a few hours anyway. And there wasn't much of Poland to see anyway. The annoying part was being so cut off. He had satellite radios in his vehicles, somewhere on the flat cars aft of this coach, but he couldn't get to them, and without them he didn't know what was happening up forward. A war was on, he knew that, but it wasn't the same as knowing the details, knowing where the train would stop, where and when he'd get to offload his equipment, get the quarter horse organized, and get back on the road where they belonged. The train part was working well. The Russian train service seemingly had a million flat cars designed expressly to transport tracked vehicles, undoubtedly intended to take their battle tanks west, into Germany for a war against NATO. Little had the builders ever suspected that the cars would be used to bring American tanks east to help defend Russia against an invader. Well, nobody could predict the future more than a few weeks. At the moment, he would have settled for 5 days or so. The rest of First Armored was stretched back hundreds of miles on the east-west rail line. Colonel Don Lyle's 2nd Brigade was just finishing up boarding in Berlin, and would be tail-end Charlie for the division. They'd cross Poland in daylight, for what that was worth. The quarter horse was in the lead where it belonged. Wherever the drop-off point was, they'd set up perimeter security, and then lead the march farther east, in a maneuver called Advance to Contact, which was where the fun started. And he needed to be well-rested for that, Colonel Giusti reminded himself. So he settled back in his seat and closed his eyes, surrendering his body to the jerks and sways of the train car. Dawn patrol was what fighter pilots all thought about. The title for the duty went back to a 1930s Errol Flynn movie, and the term had probably originated with a real mission name, meaning to be the first up on a new day, to see the sunrise, and to seek out the enemy right after breakfast. Bronco Winters didn't look much like Errol Flynn, but that was okay. You couldn't tell a warrior by the look of his face, though you could tell by the look on his face. He was a fighter pilot. As a youngster in New York, he'd ride the subway to LaGuardia Airport, just to stand at the fence and watch the airplanes take off and land, knowing even then that he wanted to fly. He'd also known that fighters would be more fun than airliners, and known finally that to fly fighters, he had to enter a service academy. And to do that, he'd have to study. And so he'd worked hard all through school, especially in math and science, because airplanes were mechanical things, and that meant that science determined how they worked. So, he was something of a math whiz, that had been his college major at Colorado Springs. But his interest in it had ended the day he'd walked into Columbus Air Force Base in Mississippi, because once he got his hands on the controls of an aircraft, the study part of his mission was accomplished, and the learning part really began. He'd been the number one student in his class at Columbus, quickly and easily mastering the Cessna Tweety Bird trainer,
and then moving on to fighters. And since he'd been number one in his class, he'd gotten his choice. And that choice, of course, had been the F-15 Eagle fighter, the strong and handsome grandson of the F-4 Phantom. An easy plane to fly, it was a harder one to fight, since the controls for the combat systems are located on the stick and the throttles, all in buttons of different shapes, so that you could manage all the systems by feel, and keep your eyes up and out of the aircraft instead of having to look down at instruments. It was something like playing two pianos at the same time, and it had taken Winters a disappointing 6 months to master. But now those controls came as naturally as twirling the wax into his Bismarck mustache, his one non-standard affectation, which he'd modeled on Robin Olds, a legend in the American fighter community, an instinctive pilot and a thinking, and therefore a very dangerous, tactician. An ace in World War II, an ace in Korea, and also an ace over North Vietnam, Olds was one of the best who'd ever strapped a fighter plane to his back, and one whose mustache had made Otto von Bismarck himself look like a pussy. Colonel Winters wasn't thinking about that now. The thoughts were there even so, as much a part of his character as his situational awareness, the part of his brain that kept constant track of the three-dimensional reality around him at all times. Flying came as naturally to him as it did to the Gerfalcon mascot at the Air Force Academy. And so did hunting. And now he was hunting. His aircraft had instrumentation that downloaded the take from the AWACS aircraft 150 miles to his rear, and he divided his eye time equally between the sky around him and the display 3 feet from his 20/10 brown eyes. There. 200 miles, bearing 172. Four bandits heading north. Then four more. And another flight of four. Joe Chink was coming up to play, and the pigs were hungry. Boer lead, this is Eagle 2. They were using encrypted burst transmission radios that were very difficult to detect and impossible to listen in on. Boer lead. But he kept his transmission short anyway. Why spoil the surprise? Boer lead, we have 16 bandits. 170, your position at Angel 30, coming due north at 500 knots. Got 'em. They're still south of the border, but not for long, the young controller on the E-3B advised. Boer, you are weapons-free at this time. Copy, weapons-free, Colonel Winters acknowledged, and his left hand flipped a button to activate his systems. A quick look down to his weapon status display showed that everything was ready to fire. He didn't have his tracking targeting radar on, though it was in standby mode. The F-15 had essentially been designed as an appendage to the monstrous radar in its nose, a design consideration that had defined the size of the fighter from the first sketch on paper. But over the years, the pilots had gradually stopped using it, because it could warn an enemy with the right sort of threat receiver, telling him that there was an eagle in the neighborhood with open eyes and sharp claws. Instead, he could now cross-load the radar information from the AWACS, whose radar signals were unwelcome, but nothing an enemy could do anything about, and not directly threatening. The Chinese would be directed and controlled by ground radar, and the Boers were just at the fuzzy edge of that, maybe spotted, maybe not. Somewhere to his rear, a rivet joint EC-135 was monitoring both the radar and the radios used by the Chinese ground controllers, and would cross-load any warnings to the AWACS. But so far, none of that. So, Joe Chink was coming north. Eagle, Boer, say bandit type, over. Boer, we're not sure, but probably Sierra Uniform 27s by point of origin and flight profile, over. Roger. Okay, good, Winters thought. They thought the Su-27 was a pretty hot aircraft, and for a Russian-designed bird it was respectable. They put their best drivers into the flanker, and they'd be the proud ones, the ones who thought they were as good as he was. Okay, Joe, let's see how good you are. Boer, lead, come left to 135. 2, 3, 4, the flight acknowledged, and they all banked to the left. Winters took a look around to make sure he wasn't leaving any contrails to give away his position. Then he checked his threat receiver. It was getting some chirps from Chinese search radar, but still below the theoretical detection threshold. That would change in 20 miles or so. But then they'd just be unknowns on the Chinese screens, and fuzzy ones at that. Maybe the ground controllers would radio a warning, but maybe they'd just peer at their screens and try to decide if they were real contacts or not. The robin's egg blue of the Eagles wasn't all that easy to spot visually, especially when you had the sun behind you, which was the oldest trick in the fighter pilot Bible, and one for which there was still no solution. The Chinese passed to his right, 30 miles away, heading north and looking for Russian fighters to engage, because the Chinese would want to control the sky over the battlefield they'd just opened up. That meant that they'd be turning on their own search radars, and when that happened, they'd spend most of their time looking down at the scope instead of out at the sky, and that was dangerous. When he was south of them, Winters brought his flight right, west, and down to 20,000 feet, well below Joe Chink's cruising altitude, because fighter pilots might look back and up, but rarely back and down, because they'd been taught that height, like speed, was life. And so it was, most of the time. In another 3 minutes, they were due south of the enemy, and Winters increased power to maximum dry thrust so as to catch up. His flight of four split on command into two pairs. He went left, and then his eyes spotted them, dark flecks on the brightening blue sky. They were painted the same light gray the Russians liked, and that would be a real problem if Russian flankers entered the area, because you didn't often get close enough to see if the wings had red stars or white-blue-red flags painted on them. The audio tone came next. His sidewinders could see the heat bloom from the Lyulka turbofan engines, and that meant he was just about close enough. His wingman, a clever young lieutenant, was now about 500 yards to his right, doing his job, which was covering his leader. Okay, Bronco Winters thought. He had a good 100 knots of overtake speed now. Boar, Eagle, be advised these guys are heading directly for us at the moment. Not for long, Eagle, Colonel Winters responded. They weren't flex anymore. Now they were twin-rudder fighter aircraft, cruising north, tucked in nice and pretty. His left forefinger selected Sidewinder to start, and the tone in his earphones was nice and loud. He'd start with two shots, one at the leftmost flanker, and the other at the rightmost, right about... Fox 2 with two birds away, Bronco reported. The smoke trails diverged, just as he wanted them to, streaking in on their targets. His gunsight camera was operating, and the picture was being recorded on videotape, just as it had been over Saudi the previous year. He needed one kill to make ace. He got the first 6 seconds later, and the next half a second after that. Both flankers tumbled right. The one on the left nearly collided with his wingman, but missed, and tumbled violently as pieces started coming off the airframe. The other one was rolling and then exploded into a nice white puffball. The first pilot ejected cleanly, but the second didn't. Tough luck, Joe, Winters thought. The remaining two Chinese fighters hesitated, but both then split and started maneuvering in diverging directions. Winters switched on his radar and followed the one to the left. He had radar lock, and it was well within the launch parameters for his AMRAAM. His right forefinger squeezed the pickle switch. Fox 1, slammer on guy to the west. He watched the slammer, as it was called, race in. Technically a fire-and-forget weapon like the Sidewinder, it accelerated almost instantly to Mach 2+, and rapidly ate up the 3 miles between them. It only took about 10 seconds to close and explode a mere few feet over the fuselage of its target, and that flanker disintegrated with no chute coming away from it. OK-3. This morning was really shaping up, but now the situation went back to World War I. He had to search for targets visually, and searching for jet fighters in a clear sky wasn't... there.
You with me, Skippy? He called on the radio.
Got you covered, Bronco, his wingman replied. Bandit at your 1 o'clock, going left to right.
On him, Winters replied, putting his nose on the distant spot in the sky.
His radar spotted it, locked onto it, and the IFF transponder didn't say friendly.
He triggered off his second slammer.
Fox 1 on the south guy. Eagle, Boer lead, how we doing?
We show 5 kills to this point. Bandits are heading east and diving. Razorback is coming in from your west with 4, Angel 3-5 at 600, now at your 10 o'clock. Check your IFF, Boer lead.
The controller was being careful, but that was okay.
Boer, lead, check IFF now.
2, 3, 4,
they all chimed in.
Before the last of them confirmed his IFF transponder was in the transmit setting, his second slammer found its target, running his morning score to 4.
Well, damn, Winters thought, this morning is really shaping up nice.
Bronco, Skippy is on 1, his wingman reported, and Winters took position behind, low, and left of his wingman.
Skippy was First Lieutenant Mario Acosta, a red-haired infant from Wichita who was coming along nicely for a child with only 200 hours in type.
Fox 2 with 1, Skippy called.
His target had turned south and was heading almost straight into the streaking missile. Winters saw the sidewinder go right into his right side intake, and the resulting explosion was pretty impressive.
Eagle, Boer lead, give me a vector, over.
Boer lead, come right at 090. I have a bandit at 10 miles and low, Angels 10, heading south at 600 plus.
Winters executed the turn and checked his radar display.
Got him.
And this one also was well within the slammer envelope.
Fox 1 with slammer.
His 5th missile of the day leaped off the rail and rocketed east, angling down. And again Winters kept his nose on the target, ensuring that he'd get it on tape.
Yes.
That's a splash. Bronco has a splash. I think that's 5.
Confirm 5 kills to Bronco, Eagle 2 confirmed.
Nice going, buddy.
What else is around?
Boer lead, the bandits are running south on burner, just went through Mach 1.
We show a total of 9 kills plus 1 damage, with 6 bandits running back to the barn, over.
Roger, copy that, Eagle. Anything else happening at the moment?
That's a negative, Boer lead.
Where's the closest tanker?
You can tank from Oliver 6, vector 005, distance 200, over.
Roger that. Flight, this is Bronco. Let's assemble and head off to tank. Form up on me.
2, 3, 4.
How we doing?
Skippy has 1, his wingman reported.
Ducky has 2, the second element leader chimed in.
Ghost Man has 2 and a scratch.
It didn't add up, Winters thought. Hell, maybe the AWACS guys got confused. That's why they had videotape.
All in all, not a bad morning. Best of all, they'd put a real dent in the Chi-Com flanker inventory, and probably punched a pinhole in the confidence of their SU-27 drivers. Shaking up a fighter jock's confidence was almost as good as a kill, especially if they'd bagged the squadron commander. It would make the survivors mad, but it would make them question themselves, their doctrine, and their aircraft. And that was good.
So?
The border defenses did about as well as one could reasonably expect, Colonel Aliyev replied. The good news is that most of our men escaped with their lives. Total dead is under 20, with 15 wounded.
What do they have across the river now?
Best guess, elements of 3 mechanized divisions. The Americans say that they now have 6 bridges completed and operating, so we can expect that number to increase rapidly. Chinese reconnaissance elements are pushing forward. We've ambushed some of them, but no prisoners yet. Their direction of advance is exactly what we anticipated, as is their speed of advance to this point.
Is there any good news? Bondarenko asked.
Oh, yes, General. Our Air Force and our American friends have given their Air Force a very bloody nose. We've killed over 30 of their aircraft with only 4 losses to this point, and 2 of the pilots have been rescued. We've captured 6 Chinese pilots. They're being taken west for interrogation. It's unlikely that they'll give us any really useful information, though I am sure the Air Force will want to grill them for technical things. Their plans and objectives are entirely straightforward, and they are probably right on or even slightly in advance of their plans.
None of this was a surprise to General Bondarenko, but it was unpleasant even so. His intelligence staff was doing a fine job of telling him what they knew and what they expected. But it was like getting a weather report in winter. Yes, it was cold, and yes, it was snowing. And no, the cold and the snow will probably not stop. And isn't it a shame you don't have a warm coat to wear? He had nearly perfect information, but no ability to do anything to change the news. It was all very good that his airmen were killing Chinese airmen, but it was the Chinese tanks and infantry carriers that he had to stop.
When will we be able to bring air power to bear on their spearheads?
We will start air-to-ground operations this afternoon with Su-31 ground attack aircraft, Aliyev replied.
But what? Bondarenko demanded.
But isn't it better to let them come in with minimal interference for a few days? It was a courageous thing for his operations officer to say. It was also the right thing, Gennady Yosifovich realized on reflection. If his only strategic option was to lay a deep trap, then why waste what assets he had before the trap was fully set? This was not the Western Front in June of 1941. And he didn't have Stalin sitting in Moscow with a figurative pistol to his head. No, in Moscow now, the government would be raising all manner of political hell, probably calling for an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council. But that was just advertising. It was his job to defeat these yellow barbarians, and doing that was a matter of using what power he had in the most efficient manner possible. And that meant drawing them out. It meant making their commander as confident as a schoolyard bully looking down at a child 5 years his junior. It meant giving them what the Japanese had once called the victory disease. Make them feel invincible, and then leap at them like a tiger dropping from a tree.
Andrei, only a few aircraft, and tell them not to risk themselves by pressing their attacks too hard. We can hurt their air force, but their ground forces... We let them keep their advantage for a while. Let them get fat on this fine table set before them for a while.
I agree, Comrade General. It's a hard pill to swallow, but in the end, harder for them to eat, assuming our political leadership allows us to do the right thing.
Yes, that is the real issue at hand, isn't it?
Chapter 52. Deep Battle. General Peng crossed over into Russia in his command vehicle, well behind the 1st Regiment of heavy tanks. He thought of using a helicopter, but his operations staff warned him that the air battle was not going as well as the featherheads in the PLAAF had told him to expect. He felt uneasy crossing the river in an armored vehicle on a floating bridge, like a brick tied to a balloon. But he did so, listening as his operations officer briefed him on the progress to this point. The Americans have surged a number of fighter aircraft forward, and along with them their E-3 airborne radar fighter-controlled aircraft. These are formidable and difficult to counter, though our Air Force colleagues say that they have tactics to deal with them.
I will believe that when I see it, Colonel Waugh observed. But that is the only bad news so far. We are several hours ahead of schedule. Russian resistance is lighter than I expected. The prisoners we've taken are very disheartened at their lack of support.
Is that a fact? Peng asked, as they left the ribbon bridge and thumped down on Russian soil.
Yes, we have 10 men captured from their defensive positions. We'll see them in a few minutes. They had escape tunnels and personnel carriers set to evacuate the men. They didn't expect to hold for long, Colonel Waugh went on. They planned to run away, rather than defend to the last as we expected.
I think they lack the heart for combat, Comrade General. That information got Peng's attention. It was important to know the fighting spirit of one's enemy,
Did any of them stand and fight to the end?
Only one of their bunker positions. It cost us 30 men, but we took them out.
Perhaps their escape vehicle was destroyed and they had no choice, the colonel speculated.
I want to see one of these positions at once, Peng ordered.
Of course, Comrade General.
Hua ducked inside and shouted an order to the track driver. The Type 90 armored personnel carrier lurched to the right, surprising the MP who was trying to do traffic control. But he didn't object. The four tall radio whips told him what sort of track this was. The command carrier moved off the beaten track directly toward an intact Russian bunker. General Peng got out, ducking his head as he did so, and walked toward the mainly intact old gun turret. The inverted frying pan shape told him that this was off an old Stalin III tank, a very formidable vehicle once upon a time, but now an obvious relic. A team of intelligence specialists was there. They snapped to attention when they saw the general approach.
"What did we kill it with?" Peng asked.
"We didn't, Comrade General. They abandoned it after firing 15 cannon shots and about 300 machine gun rounds. They didn't even destroy it before we captured it," the intelligence captain reported, waving the general down the tank hatch.
"It's safe. We checked for booby traps."
Peng climbed down. He saw what appeared to be a comfortable small barracks, shell storage for their big tank gun, ample rounds for their two machine guns. There were empty rounds for both types of guns on the floor, along with wrappers for field rations. It appeared to be a comfortable position, with bunks, shower, toilet, and plenty of food storage. Something worth fighting for, the general thought.
"How did they leave?" Peng asked.
"This way," the young captain said, leading him north into the tunnel. "You see, the Russians planned for everything."
The tunnel led under the crest of the hill to a covered parking pad for, probably for a BTR, it looked like, confirmed by the wheel tracks on the ground immediately off the concrete pad.
"How long did they hold?"
"We took the place just less than 3 hours after our initial bombardment. So we had infantry surrounding the main gun emplacement, and soon thereafter they ran away," the captain told his army commander.
"I see. Good work by our assault infantry."
Then Peng saw that Colonel Waugh had brought his command track over the hill to the end of the escape tunnel, allowing him to hop right aboard.
"Now what?" Waugh asked.
"I want to see what we did to their artillery support positions."
Waugh nodded and relayed the orders to the track commander. That took 15 minutes of bouncing and jostling. The 15 heavy guns were still there, though the two Peng passed had been knocked over and destroyed by counter-battery fire. The position they visited was mainly intact, though a number of rockets had fallen close aboard, near enough that three bodies were still lying there untended next to their guns, the bodies surrounded by sticky pools of mainly dried blood. More men had survived, probably. Close to each gun was a 2-meter-deep narrow trench lined with concrete that the bombardment hadn't done more than chip. Close by also was a large ammo storage bunker with rails on which to move the shells and propellant charges to the guns. The door was open.
"How many rounds did they get off?" he asked.
"No more than 10, another intelligence officer, this one a major, replied. "Our counter-battery fire was superb here. The Russian battery was 15 guns total. One of them got off 20 shots, but that was all. We had them out of action in less than 10 minutes. The artillery tracker radars worked brilliantly, Comrade General."
Peng nodded agreement.
"So it would appear. This emplacement would have been fine 20 or 30 years ago, good protection for the gunners and a fine supply of shells. But they did not anticipate an enemy with the ability to pinpoint their guns so rapidly. If it stands still, Wah, you can kill it."
Peng looked around.
"Still, the engineers who sighted this position and the other one, they were good. It's just that this sort of thing is out of date. What were our total casualties?"
Killed, 350, thereabouts. Wounded, 620, operations replied. It was not exactly cheap, but less than we expected. If the Russians had stood and fought, it could have been far worse.
Why did they run so soon? Peng asked. Do we know?
We found a written order in one of the bunkers, authorizing them to leave when they thought things were untenable.
That surprised me, Colonel Waugh observed.
Historically, the Russians fight very hard on the defense, as the Germans found.
But that was under Stalin. The Russians had discipline then. And courage.
Not today, it would seem.
Their evacuation was conducted with some skill, Peng thought out loud. We ought to have taken more prisoners.
They ran too fast, Comrade General, operations explained.
He who fights and runs away, Colonel Peng quoted, lives to fight another day. Bear that in mind, Colonel.
Yes, Comrade General, but he who runs away is not an immediate threat.
Let's go, the General said, heading off to his command track. He wanted to see the front, such as it was.
So? Bondarenko asked the lieutenant. The youngster had been through a bad day, and being required to stand and make a report to his theater commander made it no better.
Stand easy, boy. You're alive. It could have been worse.
General, we could have held if we'd been given a little support, Komonov said, allowing his frustration to appear.
There was none to give you. Go on.
The general pointed at the map on the wall. They crossed here, and came through this saddle and over this ridge to attack us. Leg infantry, no vehicles that we ever saw. They had man-portable anti-tank weapons, nothing special or unexpected, but they had massive artillery support. There must have been an entire battery concentrated just on my one position. Heavy guns, 15 centimeter or more. And artillery rockets that wiped out our artillery support almost immediately.
That's the one surprise they threw at us, Aliyev confirmed. They must have a lot more of those firefinder systems than we expected, and they're using their Type 83 rockets as dedicated counter-battery weapons, like the Americans did in Saudi. It's an effective tactic. We'll have to go after their counter-battery systems, first of all, or use self-propelled guns to fire and move after only 2 or 3 shots. There's no way to spoof them that I know of, and jamming radars of that type is extremely difficult.
So, we have to work on a way to kill them early on, Bondarenko said. We have electronic intelligence units. Let them seek out those chink radars and eliminate them with rockets of our own.
He turned.
Go on, Lieutenant. Tell me about the Chinese infantry.
They are not cowards, Comrade General. They take fire and act properly under it. They are well drilled. My position and the one next to us took down at least 200, and they kept coming. Their battle drill is quite good, like a soccer team. If you do this, they do that, almost instantly. For certain, they call in artillery fire with great skill.
They had the batteries already lined up, Lieutenant, lined up and waiting, Aliyev told the junior officer. It helps if you are following a prepared script.
Anything else?
We never saw a tank. They had us taken out before they finished their bridges. Their infantry looked well-prepared, well-trained, even eager to move forward. I did not see evidence of flexible thinking, but I did not see much of anything. And as you say, their part of the operation was pre-planned and thoroughly rehearsed.
Typically, the Chinese tell their men a good deal about their planned operations beforehand. They don't believe in secrecy the way we do, Aliyev said. Perhaps it makes for comradely solidarity on the battlefield.
But things are going their way, Andrei. The measure of an army is how it reacts when things go badly. We haven't seen that yet, however.
And would they ever? Bondarenko wondered. He shook his head. He had to banish that sort of thinking from his mind. If he had no confidence, how could his men have it?
What about your men, Valery Mikhailovich? How did they fight?
We fought, Comrade General. Komonov assured the senior officer. We killed 200, and we would have killed many more with a little artillery support.
Will your men fight some more? Aliyev asked.
Fuck yes, Komonov snarled back.
Those little bastards are invading our country. Give us the right weapons and we'll fucking kill them all.
Did you graduate tank school?
Komonov bobbed his head like a cadet.
Yes, Comrade General. 8th in my class.
Give him a company with Boyar, the general told his ops officer. They're short of officers.
Major General Marion Diggs was in the third train out of Berlin. It wasn't his choosing, just the way things worked out. He was 30 minutes behind Angelo Giusti's cavalry squadron. The Russians were running their trains as closely together as safety allowed, and probably even shading that somewhat. What was working was that the Russian national train system was fully electrified, which meant that the engines accelerated well out of stations and out of the slow orders caused by track problems, which were numerous. Diggs had grown up in Chicago. His father had been a Pullman porter with the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad, working the superchief between Chicago and Los Angeles until the passenger service had died in the early 1970s. Then, remarkably enough, he'd changed unions to become an engineer. Marion remembered riding with him as a boy, and loving the feel of such a massive piece of equipment under his hands. And so, when he'd gone to West Point, he decided to be a tanker, and, better yet, a cavalryman. Now he owned a lot of heavy equipment. It was his first time in Russia, a place he certainly hadn't expected to see when he'd been in the first half of his uniformed career, when the Russians he'd worried about seeing had been mainly from 1st Guards Tank and 3rd Shock Armies. Those massive formations that had once sat in East Germany, always poised to take a nice little drive to Paris, or so NATO had feared. But no more now that Russia was part of NATO, an idea that was like something from a bad science fiction movie. There was no denying it, however. Looking out the windows of the train car, he could see the onion-topped spires of Russian Orthodox churches, ones that Stalin had evidently failed to tear down. The rail yards were pretty familiar. Never the most artistic examples of architecture or city planning. They looked the same as the dreary yards leading into Chicago or any other American city. No, only the train yards that you built under your Christmas tree every year were pretty. But they didn't have any Christmas trees in evidence here. The train rolled to a stop, probably waiting for a signal to proceed. But no, this looked to be some sort of military terminal. Russian tanks were in evidence off to the right, and a lot of sloped concrete ramps. The Russians had probably built this place to ship their own tracked vehicles west, he judged.
General, a voice called.
Yo!
Somebody here to see you, sir, the same voice announced.
Diggs stood and walked back to the sound. It was one of his junior staff officers, a new one fresh from Leavenworth, and behind him was a Russian general officer.
You are Diggs? The Russian asked in fair English.
That's right.
Come with me, please.
The Russian walked out onto the platform. The air was fresh, but they were under low gray clouds this morning.
You going to tell me how things are going out east? Diggs asked.
We wish to fly you and some of your staff to Chabarsaville so that you can see for yourself.
That made good sense, Diggs thought.
How many?
6, plus you.
Okay.
The general nodded and reached for the captain, who'd summoned him from his seat.
I want Colonels Masterman, Douglas, Welch, Turner, Major Hurst, and Lieutenant Colonel Garvey.
Yes, sir.
The boy disappeared.
How soon?
The transport is waiting for you now.
One of theirs, Diggs thought. He'd never flown on a Russian aircraft before. How safe would it be? How safe would it be to fly into a war zone? Well, the army didn't pay him to stay in safe places.
Who are you?
Nosenko, Valentin Nosenko, General Major Stavka.
How bad is it?
It is not good, General Diggs. Our main problem will be getting reinforcements to the theater of action. But they have rivers to cross. The difficulties, as you Americans say, should even out.
Diggs's main worry was supply.
His tanks and Bradley's all had basic ammo loads already aboard, and 2.5 additional such loads for each vehicle were on supply trucks sitting on other trains like this one. After that, things got a little worrisome, especially for artillery. But the biggest worry of all was diesel fuel. He had enough to move his division maybe 300 or 400 miles. That was a good long way in a straight line, but wars never allowed troops to travel in straight lines. That translated to maybe 200 miles of actual travel at best, and that was not an impressive number at all. Then there was the question of jet fuel for his organic aircraft. So his head logistician, Colonel Ted Douglas, was the first guy he needed, after Masterman, his operations brain. The officers started showing up.
"What gives, sir?" Masterman asked.
"We're flying east to see what's going on."
"Okay, let me make sure we have some communications gear."
Masterman disappeared again. He left the train car along with 2 enlisted men humping satellite radio equipment. "Good call, Duke," LTC Garvey observed. He was communications and electronic intelligence for First Tanks.
"Gentlemen, this is General Nosenko from Stavka. He's taking us east, I gather."
"Correct. I am an intelligence officer for Stavka. This way, please."
He led them off to where 4 cars were waiting. The drive to a military airport took 20 minutes.
"How are your people taking this?" Diggs asked.
"The civilians, you mean?"
"Too soon to tell. Much disbelief, but some anger."
"Anger is good," Nosenko said. "Anger gives courage and determination."
If the Russians were talking about anger and determination, the situation must be pretty bad, Diggs thought, looking out at the streets of the Moscow suburbs.
"What are you moving east ahead of us?"
"So far, 4 motor rifle divisions," Nosenko answered. "Those are our best prepared formations. We are assembling other forces."
"I've been out of touch. What else is NATO sending? Anything?" Diggs asked next.
"A British brigade is forming up now, the men based at Horna. We hope to have them on the way here in 2 days.
"No way we'd go into action without at least the Brits to back us up," Diggs said.
"Good. They're equipped about the same way we are.
And better yet, they trained according to the same doctrine." Hona, he thought. "Their 22nd Brigade from Hague Barracks, Brigadier Sam Turner. Drank whiskey like it was Perrier, but a good thinker and a superior tactician. And his brigade was all trained up from some fun and games down at Grafenvoor."
"What about Germans?"
"That's a political question," Nosenko admitted.
"Tell your politicians that Hitler's dead, Valentin. The Germans are pretty good to have on your side. Trust me, buddy. We play with them all the time. They're down a little from 10 years ago, but the German soldier ain't no dummy, and neither are his officers. Their reconnaissance units are particularly good."
"Yes, but that is a political question," Nosenko repeated, and that, Diggs knew, was that, at least for now.
The aircraft waiting was an IL-86, known to NATO as the Camber, manifestly the Russian copy of Lockheed's C-141 Starlifter. This one had Aeroflot commercial markings, but retained the gun position in the tail that the Russians liked to keep on all their tactical aircraft. Diggs didn't object to it at the moment. They'd scarcely had the chance to sit down and strap in when the aircraft started rolling.
"In a hurry, Valentin?"
"Why wait, General Diggs? There's a war on," he reminded his guest.
"Okay, what do we know?"